Hey you, how's it going? My name is Ruby Price and welcome to episode 6 of Fresh From The Scene. We're approaching Christmas now, so I hope you've, you know, finished your shopping, because if you've not, you're in for a bit of a rush. Yeah. Speaking of rushes though, don't rush this podcast. Listen to it at 1x the speed. I know that some people are tempted to listen to podcasts at, you know, 2x the speed, 1.5x the speed, 1.75x the speed. This isn't a nightcore podcast, this is a podcast, so... yeah, don't rush this. For the optimal listening quality, I suggest you listen at 1x the speed. If you want to get in touch with the podcast about anything, you can find us on Twitter at FFTScene, that's FFTScene, or alternatively, you can find me on Twitter at Rubes. I'm also on Instagram at Rubes001, just use hashtag FFTS. Today we're talking to someone who's a little bit different to the previous guest that we've had, and you're about to see why. In today's episode of Fresh From The Scene, take it away.
You're listening to Fresh From The Scene with your host, Ruby Price.
Welcome to Fresh From The Scene. Today's guest is Josh Fielden.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm all right, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
He's a bit ill, so
a little bit
excuse.
Under the weather, yeah, but excuses for the snuffly voice, but we'll get there.
We'll get there. I mean, my voice is monotonous as hell, so monotonous.
Perfect. Monotonous.
Monotonous.
Wow, we're both at it today.
We're both at it today. For those of you who are unaware, Josh Fielden is a producer, and why is that?
Why is that? Good question. Well, I mean, I've always been a bass player of... 14, 15 years now, something like that. And I came to the University of Huddersfield to study a music tech degree. Very quickly got snapped up in a myriad of bands, starting with Social Wildcard, still working with Mahatma Raindrop, despite the hiatus status, I like that phrase.
Hiatus status.
Working with Elicorn, and just through those contacts in those bands, and my own desire to make music in my vision and the way that I wanted to hear it, at the standard that I wanted to hear it, got into production. Sort of stepped away from the composing and performing aspect because I felt at the time I already had enough experience. Like I say, I'd been performing bass since I was 13. So I'm used to being on stage and I practice a lot. And the next obvious step for me was to get into production and see what I could do with other people's songs. And that's... throughout the course, I found that I found my strength in taking other people's material and helping them bring more life, more energy to it, try and create it in their vision as well as a little bit of my input. And I found that I just had a bit of a natural knack for that. So I decided to go for it my final year in particular, learned all the tricks of the trade. And since I've been doing it since then.
What would you say it's like producing for a client rather than for yourself?
I think it's really, really important to respect the artist's vision. Mm. I've definitely not done this. So everything that I say that I think is important now, I have actually done the opposite. The inverse is true, and that's where I've learned from my mistakes. But it's definitely important to, like, the first thing I'll do with a prospective client or anybody who wants to make music with me is question them. Not interrogate them, question them about what is the vision of the song, in particular with Alex Vallejo, who's been on your show previously. It's instrumental, progressive rock music. Now, sometimes that comes with the caveat of it being super technical guitar solos, somewhat has the stigma of being, like, emotionless, particularly because it doesn't have any vocalist. So when I sat down with Alex for the first time, I was like, where does this song come from? What's, like, the emotional meaning of this song? And it turns out, after I had that conversation, that there's a lot of very heavy emotions tied to the way he writes his music. So I kept that in mind. It was sort of like the title of the page,
yeah,
of the blank canvas that we were then going to create the music upon. So, for example, In Our Time, it's kind of like it's a ballad, really. It's not really a progressive rock song. And he always described it to me as it's sort of like a physical journey of going down your path and having like a physical resistance, like traipsing through mud and struggling to get through this difficult path. And then at the end, it's you've got through it and it's this big uplifting kind of thing. The way I approach that is sometimes I said to him, you know, maybe you're overplaying this part. again, because it's got the caveat of being virtuosic guitar, I was like, maybe actually if we take a few notes out and just hook that melody into people's brains first, and then later on in the song during the triumphant section, then you can kind of go wild and embellish it with more notes. And then there's a production thing as well. So the mud, people use mud in production, in mixing, as a sound quality of this sort of like, you know, low mid cluster.
Mm.
It's usually quite undesirable. But what I did, knowing the intention of the song and when it came to mixing it, is I just created what I called the mud bus. it was a bus in my DAW, and it was just this low mid distorted. I mean, if you were to listen to it in isolation, you'd be like, what the heck are you doing? Like, this is not desirable at all. But during that section, I automated it in, and I was like, yeah, this is kind of got that low mud sound. And the way we performed it as well, I dragged the tempo a little bit, so I got the drums to be behind the beat. And I think that was really effective. So things like that, I mean, that's a very, very specific example. But it's important to know what your artistic intention is.
Yeah.
Coming back to the origin of that long tail. Yeah, it's really important to keep other people's vision. When you're doing it for yourself, of course, you know what you think you want it to sound like. You kind of, you're your own agent then. You know, if I want this guitar to be loud here and the solo to be wicked loud, then I'll just do that. The only peers in that are the rest of the band. And thankfully, the people that I'm in bands with are brilliant, and they usually just let me do my thing. And they'll only say something if it's, you know, it's really not right, or if something slipped the net. So yeah, that's the main difference. It's sort of being a free agent against respecting the artist.
Would you say you prefer it then if someone comes in with like a fixed idea, or like do you allow for a bit more of a flexible idea that you can then input as well on?
Yeah, at the end of the day, I'm the person that's being hired to do a job, albeit in a creative capacity. But the creative capacity, again, that's such a term where the goalposts can move. So if someone came in with a fixed idea and said, this is absolutely how I want it to be, I have to respect that.
Yeah.
This goes back to the conversation. I want to build a relationship with that person or people, where maybe at one point I feel comfortable in saying, actually, can we just try this?
Yeah.
And I think that's the way you've got to approach it. You can't say, this has to change, because it's art is delicate.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to find yourself suggesting too many things and they're having a conversation in the back room saying, oh, this guy's giving us too many suggestions, this guy's trying to take over our music. You've got to find a very, very fine balance. But that just comes down to relationships, really. I think I've been very fortunate in that the records that I've produced, 5 or 6 records that I've produced so far, everybody's been very receptive to what I've said.
Mm.
But again, I spend a lot of time thinking about how far is appropriate, whether I'm right or wrong. And that's where the question becomes, let's just try this. It might not stick. It might be a rubbish idea. Don't get me wrong, I've had plenty of terrible ideas.
I mean, haven't we all?
Yeah, exactly. But at least we've tried it and we've figured out that maybe that's not the thing, you know.
Mm.
That we want. It's kind of like, I kind of think of the whole process, if it's got momentum to it, and it's kind of like finding the clutch in your car. It's kind of finding like where the biting point is.
Yeah.
In a creative sense.
The bit where it's like just before, you know, like it actually gets things moving.
Yeah.
But just not enough away so that, you know, there's no, you know, momentum there at all.
Totally. So you've got your foot down on the clutch and that's ground zero. That's like your first meeting with the client. And then as your relationship and the songs are flowing, you're bringing it up. And if you're not quite in gear, you're just going to keep crunching on that clutch and it's going to go nowhere.
Yeah.
But once you find the biting point, and then you can take your foot off the clutch and full pedal to the metal on the accelerator, it's usually happy days and there's no conflicts.
Yeah.
You put that effort in to get to know the person, get to know what the music's about, and then the rest just sort of, hopefully, comes naturally.
I mean, without naming any names, like I've heard like cases of where like bands have hired a producer and then the producer has then gone and done their own thing, and sort of then the band is rather unhappy with what they've produced, but at times it's, you know, too late to do it because you spent money on the recording stuff.
Yeah, totally. There are many cases throughout music history where the production has not been what the artist wants. And that's where I feel like my strong suit is. It's just an awareness of what they mean. But again, some producers you hire because they have that sound.
Yeah.
You hire them because they do that sound. You know, if you were fortunate enough to hire Chris Lord-Alge, who knows? CLA. you know you're going to get that super 8K cranked, high shelf, super polished, modern production. Think Muse, think... Did he do Chili Peppers? I think he did Chili Peppers. I'm not the best encyclopedia for who's who of producers because I'm not the kind of producer that has that sound. Maybe I'm still trying to find my sound, but I don't ever want to be... It's like typecasting for actors.
Yeah.
I still want the flexibility to be diverse.
Yeah.
I mean, just this year, for example, Vallejo's record, instrumental prog rock, Elicorn record, prog rock, but prog metal, like scream up and heavy. Toby Burton, acoustic-y, folky...
Singer-songwriter.
Singer-songwriter-y thing. And that was actually an interesting one because that did actually have a lot of input from me in terms of the arrangement. So previously, if you've listened to his other records, there's been a little bit of drums, a little bit of bass maybe. I recorded the bass on his first EP and that's how we got to work together in a creative sense. I was just hired to play bass. And he's a great songwriter, but he felt like he wanted to just embellish it a little bit. So the things like, people have called it a synthesizer in some of the reviews for Lost and Found, but it's not. It's an Ebon, a guitar, and a load of beautiful reverbs and delays. Things like that was things that... I didn't just go into the studio with an Ebon one day and a guitar and just recorded it and just said, yeah, there you go, that's what your song sounds like now. I was like, Toby, how's about we try this, you know?
Yeah.
How's about we try this and that? And he was very receptive to those things, you know? And some songs I played bass on, some songs didn't call for bass. So I was like, yeah, no bass, whatever, cool. The drum kit actually was an aesthetic choice. At the time, we were talking about bands like Daughter.
Okay.
And Bon Iver, and they have this very particular way of using percussion. It's not like crash, bang, slam, rock drum production, you know, it's brushes and more delicate. It got to a point like I had a sound in my head for the drum kit, and it's opposite of rock drum kit, right? So it was tuning them down as low as they would go to the point where it was just kind of like a dead, like, boof kind of sound. Even the snare is as low as it would possibly go. And then, of course, the drummer. I'm not a drummer. I'm such a closeted drummer. I wish that I had drumming facilities at home so I could practice and just become this wicked drummer. But I'm not that guy. So I had to make a judgment call. This is a whole thing in production about who do I use. And I'm very fortunate to have worked with a lot of great drummers from way back from my hometown, Burnley. There's some fantastic drummers there. I miss them dearly, and I want to go back and jam with them every time I'm in town. To some brilliant drummers in Huddersfield. And Anthony Walters was the guy that I asked because I knew that he could do calm and sort of centered and not overplay it, not overhit it. You know, he was going to be very responsive to that thing. He's a nervy guy, and there's a few situations where I perhaps made him a little uncomfortable in the studio because I was throwing ideas at him. But, you know, I knew that he could adapt to him, you know. When I gave him a handful of shakers and egg shakers and tambourines or whatever, he's like, oh, well, I don't really play these, but let's have a go. And, you know, he's just got a good feel. And it was him that made I could do so much with the physical drum kit. That's my job. Mm. And where the microphone's placed and everything, that was the sound I was looking for. But the player is like 70% of that sound as well. If it had been the wrong drummer, I dread to think of... of what it could have been like. I don't think it would have been awful, but it just so happened that the right drummer on the right drum kit was that sound that we were looking for. Mm. And we were so pleased. I think up until that point, there was a bit of animosity between, is this going to work? Or am I just going to have to scrap these channels? Is the artist Toby going to like it? But as soon as we heard it and as soon as it was grooving along to the track, it was all smiles in the studio. And that's what I live for. That's the ultimate goal. Is when we're recording something, when I send a mix back, I want that person to be chuffed to bits.
Yeah.
As we say, up north.
Up north.
Up north. So, yeah, that's my ultimate goal.
Yeah, it does seem as though, like, a really good part of production is just getting everyone who's in the recording process just on the same vibe, or at least vibing to some degree.
Yeah, totally.
You know? Like, because then, theoretically, they're going to produce their best, you know, material, and that's the bit that's being recorded.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll not give you the analogy of an acid trip that I was just thinking of. But it is so much about the environment. You've got to create an environment, a vibe, a space. I think, hopefully, so far so good. I've done a good job of that. Can I give you another example of why I think producing is the one for me?
Go for it.
So coming at it from a bass player's angle, let's go with all the bass player tropes here. You're playing the root note, you're playing the one. It's pretty simple, but, you know, it's easy guitar, if you want to call it that. And I think when you're in a rehearsal space or when you're with a band, because the other instruments are probably usually more involved, you know, you've got your guitar player who's thinking about the solo that's coming up, so they get inside their own head about the solo. The drummer's playing every single subdivision in the head, you know, whereas I'm counting 1, 2, 3... Four.
Yeah.
The drummer's going, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, they can try to keep everything locked down. As a bass player, you kind of get this top-down view of the band. You're kind of at the back, you're just coasting away, you know, you've got the easy part, you think you're sitting pretty, you're getting a wage for playing like 10 notes less than everybody else in the band. But what you start to do then, what you start to do then is you free up your brain capacity to think, oh, the guitar player did something really interesting there. I'll remind them to keep that there next time. Or the drummer did a cool fill there, or did a nice dynamic fill, and they brought the volume up nicely. So I'll say, you know, do that again. That's awesome. It can be a bit tricky with some people when you like they do something and you're like, actually, maybe that wasn't the right thing. But I'm absorbing all this information because I've got the headspace to do it. I'm not doing anything super involved most of the time. And I think the same mode of thinking applies to production. You've got to have that top-down view. You've got to be aware of what everybody's doing in the room, every part that's being played. I quite often find myself sat there when I'm producing, singing harmonies, singing the melodies. I'm like, oh, I shouldn't be singing, really. I should just be mixing this thing, you know, or thinking of things. But
Becoming a fan.
Yeah, totally. I've got to be a fan of the music to make it sound good as well. As a bass player, you've got the brain capacity to be in a real-time situation and think about whatever your own part is and then be aware of what everybody else is around you. And producing, it's the same, except for it's not in real time. You're not in a band doing it live. You do have the luxury of... It's a luxury and a curse of being able to stop it, pause it, record it again, you know. And you've got to be aware of who's getting tired, if they're playing too many parts or taking too many takes. You've got to be aware of, like, oh, we're, like, 10 takes down now. Maybe it's not going to get better than that, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll just have to do whatever studio tricks to it to make it work. So it's kind of, you get this top-down vision and the producer role and the bass player role, I think, are very similar in that way.
Yeah, I mean, that does sound like there's a lot of overlaps there. Do you tend to find that you are the person approaching the artists in terms of offering a production thing, or do you find that they tend to approach you saying, hey, look, we've got this, we'd quite like to make this like an actual thing now?
Both statements are true for where I want to be at.
Yeah.
Coming into this new year now, I'm going to wind down. Christmas, it's Christmas time now, everybody's winding down. Next year, I'm going to get my website up and all the socials going. I'm the worst for social media. I'm just so apathetic towards the whole cause. Networking hasn't been a strong suit for me, but it's something that I'm actively working on now. So it's all about going out and seeing people at gigs, talking to people on the scene. You'll be surprised what you find when you just talk to someone and they're like, you know, I've got this thing. And I'm like, well, I've got this thing that I do. It's called production. And I've got a few microphones and a computer to do the rest for you. And yeah, it's a healthy combination of both, ideally. I think to get to the point where people are approaching you, you maybe got to be the kind of producer that has their sound, like I was speaking about before, or somebody who's done a lot of records. So right now, it's me approaching. I'm going to be the cold caller knocking on your door, canvassing your local area, seeing if you want your songs made.
Have you got time to hear about our local producer, Josh Field?
Yeah. Jehovah's producer. I don't know. There's a joke's been made there, but I can't think of the punchline.
You want them to approach you as well?
Yeah. And I respect that that's not going to happen before I put the groundwork in. It's going to be... It might be so that there's like a tipping scale where I'm cold calling, canvassing people, where basically begging for work, and then slowly, gradually over time, as things release, people will start asking me.
Yeah.
To the point where it balances out.
It's like they think, oh, like I really like how this album sounds. Like, oh, who produced it? And it's like Josh Fielden. It's like, oh, maybe, you know, we've got some stuff similar to this. Maybe we should, you know, approach him, see what.
Totally, yeah. And I think it goes back to, I'm gonna name drop some producers that I follow. You know, Aubrey Whitfield. She's been doing her thing for like 10 odd years, and the past 3 to 4 years have been really good for her. But she's a different kind of producer. She writes songs and produces the whole production. Mm. Generally works with people that are just singers and maybe just have a lyric book, which is not what I do. But she's, and CJ Marks as well, who's worked with Foals and Wombat, and I think she won like the Producer of the Year award for one of the groups that do the Producer of the Year award. You know, first female producer to do that. Another one as well, Bob Cooper, who's Leeds based. He's got a sound like he does rock music, you know, punk, pop punk, some metal things, but he's definitely got that sound dialed in, and he's just moved into a wicked studio that I'm endlessly envious. But again, 10 years, and it seems to be like the producers that I follow kind of have this like 10-year sort of make or break point, you know, well, maybe like 6 to 10 years make or break point. It's all about that experience of getting your portfolio out there. Sometimes it's varied and broad, other times, like in Bob Cooper's case, it's guitar music, you know. I love guitar music. I don't see myself going on an electronic tangent.
Nah.
There will be, I mean, I love synths as well, but it's definitely within the framework of guitar music, for sure. Yeah.
Like it follows like the same sort of patterns of, you know, it will have the same basic structures as guitar music, but just with a synthesized element to it.
Totally, yeah. It's like working on the same canvas. Yeah. You know, the canvas of guitars and drums and whatever. But you never know if somebody approached me with some wicked synth production songs and really wanted me to work on it, and I was just, I don't know, I guess feeling lucky or confident, I'd definitely give it a go.
Yeah.
You never know what could happen.
Drawing back to the whole, you know, like building up a rapport with the artists and stuff, like how do you get them to, you know, when they're in the studio, how do you get them to be the best that they can be?
Biscuit bribes.
Biscuit bribes.
Yeah, there'll always be biscuits on any session that I'm doing. It's essential. It goes without saying, really.
Just your production rider biscuits.
Yeah, production rider biscuits.
Any particular biscuit?
Ginger nuts, OTs. Oh, yeah, like a good, I need a good crunch, you know.
A good crunch.
Good crunch. I'm not about soft biscuits.
Nah.
I mean, back in the day, it would be custard creams, but I don't eat cream anymore, so that's kind of off the table. But yeah, I mean, anybody's welcome to bring any biscuit that they want. You know, it's a biscuit party of all varieties. But in terms of making some, what we're talking about, getting performances out of people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it can always be really awkward, even if it's the person's an experienced performer. You've got to be patient. I know about vocal technique. I've sang myself. I know about guitar technique, I know about drum technique, but I really only specialise in bass and guitar technique. So sometimes it's a case of giving soft suggestions, maybe just get them to be aware of maybe what's not working for them. Sometimes it's something as simple as changing the lighting, you know. Mm. Other times I've had singers that, like singer-songwriters in particular, love doing this, where they're so used to playing a gig with a guitar and singing that once you take the guitar element away, they forget or they don't feel comfortable singing. So it's quite often, like, I've seen people mime guitar whilst they're singing or I've just given them the guitar, you know, I've just said, just take the guitar in there, you know, whatever makes you comfortable. It really is just about, it's a case-by-case thing. And I've recorded tons of stuff myself and I definitely know what it is to see the red light go on and red light syndrome. Mm. Like we were talking before, the red light's on now, I've just looked at it, so the whole interview is going to go to shit now. And people see that red recording light and start panicking, and it's kind of, you've just got to try and guide them into a place where they can feel comfortable. Another person that I worked with, we just recorded it on the sofa, you know. Mm. I just took the laptop and the input, and thankfully we weren't using like a real guitar amp. It was just like a software virtual amp, and it was just like, just did it on the sofa with his legs crossed, you know, chill, you know, cup of tea. Just do whatever you can to make a person feel comfortable. There's nothing worse than forcing someone to do anything that they're uncomfortable with.
Yeah, because they're all going to be, you know, like seized up and...
Yeah, to add more stress to that situation, you're just going to get nowhere.
Yeah.
And I know how it feels. I've had terrible sessions. I've been in the vocal booth before. I completely bodged it, so I know what that fear is, and hopefully I've got the experience to like be the antidote to that.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you just have to be really neutral as well. You can't be either way. Mm. Sometimes you've got to be quite cold, in fact. And it's not brutal, but like really, really cold and sort of straight-faced. Because sometimes the opposite can happen if you get a bit too
relaxed,
bantery, or jovial, and people are laughing and giggling, and it goes the other way, right? So yeah, it's really about knowing the person, and reading the room,
even if it means recording with them sat on the bed.
Yeah. If that's where they're comfortable, then I'll go to the bed with the microphones. Whatever works. Like I say, I know what it is to feel that fear, so anything works. They could record doing a handstand if they like, for all I care, you know. I'm an accommodator. I've got to accommodate the songs, I've got to accommodate the performances and try and get the best out of both.
You're a Huddersfield based producer and stuff.
Huddersfield based or Huddersfield based? Like, whoa. Yeah, I start. I'm doing dubstep now.
Yeah, you have moved on.
Yeah, yeah. In the space of this interview, I've become a dubstep producer.
Been known to happen. But yeah, like, who do you think, on the local scene at least, you know, who is fresh from the scene? Who do you think is doing well?
First and foremost, I've got to give a shout out to the people that I've produced and worked with. Toby Burton's new single's just come out. It's got some wicked reviews. Pleased us all. I mean, I was in the tour van the other day and I put it on in the van. And it's kind of like a trial by fire when you put it on in the van. And I did a car listen, but the van's even worse.
Yeah.
It's like the car, but worse. And I listened to that production and I was like, damn, this could be on radio. So all power to Toby. He's great at the marketing thing. He's great. He's a brilliant songwriter, lovely guy to work with. Alex Vallejo's record, A Series of Endings, that's sort of become a little bit of a baby for me.
Yeah.
We're currently working on a big live production for that. So watch this space. Charlie Hula, who I recently performed with, and going down to Brighton to perform with. He forces me to play upright bass, which I'm not too happy about. Or at least my hand isn't too happy about. I get cramp all the time playing it. But it's a fun challenge. Wonderful songwriter. Been working on these songs for a long time. Box Tellies. At the moment, they seem to be filling up venues and getting out about the place. My good friend and bandmate, Pete Reitkirk, produced their records. I think they sound brilliant.
Yeah, they were supporting Larkins the other weekend.
And Larkins. Big shout out to them. I remember in first year, Social Wildcard played a gig in Warehouse.
Oh, was this the Radiohead Presents gig?
I mean, it was 4 or 5 years ago, so my memory fails me. But yeah, if you remember it, then I trust your memory more than mine. You are sort of like the memory gal. You've kind of got like, you know, 100,000 terabytes of memories in there. In fact, there's a trust issue because I know you maybe remember too much information. But yeah, I remember them playing in Warehouse, a small gig, you know, it's a small venue and we're literally throwing
it's not even really
gig.
A venue.
It's not a venue anymore. I mean, they only did gigs, to my knowledge, in my first year, which was 2015.
Yeah.
And they were great, you know, they were a great live band and they headlined the show and they had a great show. But they've kind of just, like, blown up, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, they were playing Leeds Fest and Leeds and Reading.
Yeah. So all power to them. I mean, the production as well. I mean, they've gone for that slightly more synthy-orientated, super modern polished thing, and it's working out for them. It's awesome. Courtyards, they played Etihad Stadium for the halftime show.
Really?
Recently, yeah. Yeah, so...
Oh, wow.
And
Big up Courtyards.
Yeah, I love the guys in that band. Callum is from my hometown. We used to play... or be associated with other college-level bands that will not bring up anymore. Luke, their drummer, fantastic guy. Love him to pieces. They're doing really well. Yeah, I'd love to record them, actually. So we could make something big together. I've already had that conversation with Luke, but depending on how many pints there was involved in that, memories could be blurred. Kill the Silence, we recently did the acoustic session, which I think they released for the fans only, which is... marginally annoying because I want it in my portfolio, but it's on YouTube, recorded by your fine self, filmed by your fine self. That was a great session.
Recorded by your fine self.
Recorded, yeah. We'll switch roles next time.
Yeah.
I'll film, you can record.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah, you can mix it. But yeah, that was a great session. It was just done in a bedroom and I'm really happy with how the result came out.
Yeah.
Great songs. Get Out, Get Out. I think I actually almost prefer it.
I prefer it acoustic. Yeah. Like, I mean, I listen to it afterwards.
It's great on the like the heavy... version of it, and it's a wicked live song as well. That definitely, when I've been to see them and they've played Get Out live, they get a crowd moving. You know, you need to go and see Kill the Silence. They're so full of energy, and we'll get you in a mosh pit whether you like it or not. But the acoustic version is wicked as well. I was really surprised by that arrangement.
Yeah, definitely.
Really a pleasant surprise.
What about on a bigger scale right now, like not just local bands, like who do you think, you know, is currently on top of their game in the music industry?
I mean, you don't get any more on top than Billie Eilish right now.
Yeah.
Like, even, like, 40-year-old metalhead dudes are into Billie Eilish. It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
She's got such a wide appeal, and the album is wicked. I mean, I listen to it regularly. And that was made in her brother's bedroom.
Was it really?
Yeah. It was just made in the tiniest bedroom in LA, wherever she's from. I think that's absolutely wicked. The minimalist, maximising the minimalist approach, I think is what's...
No, whispered vocals.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's what's happened there, to the point where it's just become this whole thing.
We already had mumble rap, now I've got whisper pop.
Whisper pop, yeah, I like it. I mean, I'm a big prog rock fan. Leprous are killing it at the moment.
Yeah.
Their last three records for me have just been a flawless, you know, string of records. That kind of consistency that they've got is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we were hanging out when I think it would have been their last record, like, was released. And we were just listening to it in the background, and like, that was my first exposure to Leprous, and I was like, this sounds pretty sick.
Oh yeah. I remember that day. Yeah. It's cool, because there was a lot of uncertainty, because they're trying to bring a bit more, dare I say, pop, but not really pop, but
just more popular music elements.
Yeah, a bit musical theatre elements, actually, as well. Very dramatic. And I think that's opened up the doors to accessibility for them, and all power to them. Go for it, you know. Wicked.
So, as a producer, that theoretically means that you should know what makes a great song.
Yeah, in theory. There's so many things. Everybody has a different taste. Everybody has their own idea of what a perfect song sounds like. For me, I've got such a broad taste of music. For me, some of the perfect songs, or some of my favourite songs, are like Forever, Forever Ago, Bon Iver. That's just an acoustic, you know. Reese Stacks, that's the one that I really, really, really... And it's just so intimate. It's just acoustic guitar, it's just vocals, it's just good lyrics. And for me, I'm not really a lyric person. I don't really necessarily... I'll catch a melody straight away, but lyrics take time to come for me, but it's only those three elements, and it's perfect.
Yeah.
Some people would consider ABBA to be perfect music, and I wouldn't argue with them, because, you know, disco, it's a party vibe. It depends on the context of perfection. Yeah, everybody has their own idea of it. That's such a egalitarian answer, but I'm going to stick with it, because it really is. I just think good, honest songwriting... There used to be a school of, like, oh, it's auto-tuned and edited or fake, or in the metal world, it was, like, drum triggers playing impossible drum parts, and that used to be sort of the stigma, and people didn't, like, shun that. But that's legitimate now.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I think that has its place. If people are listening to it, people are loving it. People like that super perfect, polished rap song, hip-hop song, super auto-tuned. It's a sound that people like. Who am I to say that it's not perfect? You know, go for it.
I agree with you there.
Yeah, but then I also feel like because of that, there's kind of like both extremes are true now.
Yeah.
Like natural, honest, intimate performance is coming back as well. And I think that's what it is. Ultimately, it's performance. Both sides, even if it's digitally manipulated. If the performance comes from a real place, an honest, artistic place, then people are going to resonate with it. If it's music for, you know, like music for TV, whatever, and it's just commercial music, whatever, people just kind of switch off to it. But if you've got an honest performance and an honest song, and you do it in whatever genre and whatever style or whatever processing, I think you're onto a winner.
To finish off, who would you like to produce for? If you could name one artist that you could just be like, right, cool, I'm borrowing you for an album. We're making
anybody
something
in the world right now?
Yeah.
Completely selfishly, Leprous. It would be. Yeah, I mean, such. They're on just another level of musicianship. I think maybe I'd probably crumble in the studio, but you know, it's like their productions are interesting because they've gone from super close, just a straight up rock metal production to having particularly a drummer who's an absolute phenomenal, like he's a force of nature. To having these room sounds, or the drums aren't super massive. They're actually kind of just a bit muted. Still playing crazy parts on them, but muted, more natural drum reverb, room sounds. I love a good drum room. Like, how it's... Any production I do, if I've got a good drum room, I'm happy. I'm a made man, and I'm working my way towards owning a studio or renting a space. And the main deciding factor for that is how good does a drum sound in this room. But yeah, Leprous, totally, hands down. Locally, Kill the Silence, I guess.
Kill the Silence.
Yeah. They're my boys. I mean, again, that's because they're friends. They're very, very close friends of mine. So, yeah, that'd be great. Just for the personal factor.
Do you have an email or something for these people to get in contact with you?
Until the website's online, no. I guess just find me on Facebook.
Yeah.
I'm always ready to have a conversation. Yeah, there's no official producer means to get in touch with me right now, but it's in the works in the new year. I'll definitely have a website and the socials going. But for now, it's just plain old me.
Josh Fielden, TBC.
Josh Fielden, yeah. I'm toying with studio names, and maybe your Twitter followers can suggest ones. My current only idea is really cheesy. It's called The Field Den.
The Field Den.
The Field Den.
I like it, but that's F-E-E-L. Probably just because it's a pun.
It is a pun, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That's my area.
Yeah.
We'll float it about.
Yeah.
See if we might get some responses on Instagram.
Yeah, it needs to be hashtagable, right?
That's exactly. The thing.
Hashtag Field End.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
No worries.
You're listening to Fresh from the Scene with Ruby Price.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not give it a share on social media at FFT Scene. FFT Scene. I always appreciate feedback. So, if you've got any comments at all, leave a review. Send me an email. All the links are in the description. I'll see you next week with another podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Goodbye.